Okay, the title of today's conference is The Catholic Intellectual and the Challenge of the Contemporary University. I invite you in the following 45 minutes to consider John Henry Newman as an exemplar of the modern Catholic intellectual and his classic work, The Idea of a University, still a must read, I think, for every serious university student, as a potent litmus test for contemporary universities. Not only does this litmus test expose the considerable challenges contemporary universities face, rather, the litmus test Newman provides in his classic work lays bare the very crisis of the modern university and identifies what is in one way the cause and in another the effect of this crisis, namely the university's counterfeit, which is the late modern mutation of the university into a polytechnicum with a liberal arts appendix. Newman's litmus test is based on a normative idea of what a university essentially is. University is not simply a label that can be attached to whatever institution. Rather, it denotes essential features of a curriculum and an institution of higher learning that is characterized by fundamental metaphysical and epistemological commitments across centuries and across cultures. To put it in a nutshell, according to Newman, a university properly conceived is founded on the unity of truth. The unity of truth, in turn, accounts for the unity of knowledge, at least for the possibility of the unity of knowledge. And the unity of knowledge accounts for the unity of a university education, at least for the possibility of the unity of a university education. The discipline that inquires into the interrelationship of all sciences and hence into the unity of truth, Newman calls the science of sciences, or, if you know what that means in classical terms, the first science. The purpose of this first science is inquiring into and finding truth, comprehensive and ultimate truth. The science of sciences constitutes the keystone of the arc of sciences, accounts for and advances the unity of knowledge, and thereby facilitates the inner coherence of a university education. This first science is the unique characteristic of a university in the proper sense. Infused into any academic field of study, its comparative, analytic, and synthetic activity of reflection connects each field with all the other fields of study and research. The apex of this first science is natural theology, or philosophical theology, the inquiry into the source and perfection of all truth. The science of sciences and the reflexivity, the integrated knowledge and critical awareness it fosters, is intrinsically useless, and therefore resists all the typically modern strategies of instrumentalizing even philosophical knowledge. It is the most liberal of all liberal arts that carry their ends in their very exercise. There are, however, two apparently irreversible facts that seem to render Newman's idea of a university and the first science at its very heart distinctly antiquated and passé. First, the research and knowledge production of the late modern research university is a thoroughly secular affair. As the noted historian Brad Gregory from the University of Notre Dame aptly put it, quote, "Regardless of the academic discipline, knowledge in the Western world today is considered secular by definition. Its assumptions, methods, content, and truth claims are and can only be secular, framed not only by the logical demand of rational coherence, but also by the methodological postulate of naturalism and its epistemological correlate, evidentiary empiricism. Unquote. Taking the methodological postulate of naturalism and its epistemological correlate evidentiary empiricism as not only given but as normative, most contemporary natural scientists will dismiss the kind of inquiry characteristic of this first science as a meaningless form of pseudoscience, something akin to parapsychology or Freudian analysis. So the latter might still be believed in New York City. The second fact is this. The kind of knowledge privileged and praised in the late modern research university is knowledge that facilitates all forms of making, of techné. It is the kind of knowledge that is essentially extrinsic to the ends that are to be achieved. It is technological know-how in the service of expanding control over natural processes or over the artificial reproduction of such processes. The very ends this highly advanced know-how serves are, however, not necessarily subject matters that would be inquired into and taught at the very core and center of these research universities. Subject matters as happiness, justice, virtue, and the end and telos of the human life and of the whole cosmos. The American Association of Universities, the exclusive club of the leading research universities in the United States of America, characterizes a research university as an institution that advances a great variety of expertise to be applied to real-world problems. Cutting-edge research is combined with undergraduate training for such research, often in highly specialized programs. This research university could be called, maybe more accurately, the Baconian Polytechnicum, named after its spiritus rector, Francis Bacon. The late modern research university, I would hold, is the Baconian Polytechnicum in its most advanced stage. It has had a stunning global career, so that, as Gregory rightly observes, quote, leading scientists and scholars at research universities are the societal and indeed the global arbiters of what counts as knowledge and what does not in the early 21st century, unquote. If this state of affairs is an evident fact and amounts to a global success, why should we be held captive by the nostalgic image of a university education long gone, if it ever existed, and even if advanced by a brilliant intellectual like John Henry Newman? Should we not simply own up to the fact that the university has irreversibly morphed into a polytechnicum beautified with a veneer of a liberal arts propedeutic, the instrumentalized fragments of a liberal arts curriculum, in short, has morphed irreversibly into its counterfeit? Yet Newman's litmus test cannot be dismissed that easily. Despite the current trend of a comprehensive instrumentalization of university education, one may observe a widespread hope still alive in many institutions of higher learning that the brand name university might allow those institutions that inspire to advance themselves from colleges to universities, as well as research universities that loathe to call themselves polytechnica, to retain at least some continuity with the normative ideal of the term university, or that the term and idea university entails. The hope is that a generally accepted academic gold standard might provide at least some shared intellectual and moral standards that might help protect these institutions at least somewhat from their total instrumentalization and commodification. Yet in order to generally retain continuity with the normative ideal of the university, these institutions have to expose themselves to Newman's litmus test, a test that might show that they are in the middle of turning into or have already turned into the university's counterfeit, the Baconian Polytechnicum. The litmus test points out that any current university that wishes to retain continuity with a normative ideal of the university must retain or retrieve the features proper to the university qua university. Newman shows that to retain or retrieve these features means nothing less than to challenge and overcome the programmatic ideological naturalism as the prescribed intellectual scope and evidentiary empiricism as the only acknowledged form to gain real scientific knowledge. In short, to dismantle what Charles Taylor calls the immanent frame, a normative frame that expects all putatively scientific knowledge to be computational, that is quantifiable and applicable in such a way that its success can be measured. At the center of Newman's normative litmus test stands the argument that the very heart of the university is the first science, the most useless science, the useless science per se, and that the very heart of this first science has to be theology, natural theology or philosophical theology. Here is Newman's utterly countercultural and foremost counterintuitive claim. Natural or philosophical theology is indispensable for the integrity of the university precisely as university, and for university curriculum precisely as university curriculum. For this reason, liberal education carries its end in itself. Liberal education is a potentially universal education. While it is impossible to embrace all or even most fields of contemporary knowledge, liberal education nevertheless fosters reflection upon one's knowledge in relation to other fields and in relation to the whole. This interrelatedness makes liberal education a potentially universal education. Such universal education requires a horizon of absolute, radical, and non-reductive transcendence. A horizon that affords a maximum of possible expansiveness, interconnectedness, and coherence. But such a horizon of transcendence can only be achieved and secured if the first science, with natural theology as its apex, is an integral part of a university education. According to Newman, the greatest danger to the inner coherence of the university is a self-imposed normative naturalism. Such a normative naturalism dramatically reduces the horizon of truth and thereby undermines the inner unity and the scope of knowledge. Newman states, quote, "Admit a God, and you introduce among the subjects of your knowledge a fact encompassing, closing in upon, absorbing every other fact conceivable. How can we investigate any part of any order of knowledge and stop short of that which enters into every order? All true principles run over with it. All phenomena converge to it. It is truly the first and the last. Granting that divine truth differs in kind from human, so do human truths differ in kind from one another. If the knowledge of the Creator is in a different order from the knowledge of the creature, so in like manner, metaphysical science is in a different order from physical science from history, and history from ethics. You will soon break up into fragments the whole circle of secular knowledge." He means by secular knowledge, knowledge that can be gained by reason, unaided by revelation. "You will soon break up into fragments the whole circle of secular knowledge if you begin the mutilation with the divine," unquote. This is from the Idea of a University, Discourse 2, Section 3. Normative naturalism is therefore, according to Newman, ultimately nothing but the university's undertaker. Newman makes good on this claim in a three-step argument. First, Newman establishes the fundamental relationship between objective truth and scientific inquiry. He does so by insisting upon a version of epistemological realism that still informs much of contemporary natural science. Quote, "Truth is the object of knowledge of whatever kind, and when we inquire what is meant by truth, I suppose it is right to answer that truth means facts and their relations. And all that exists, as contemplated by the human mind, forms one large system or complex fact. Viewed altogether, the sciences approximate to a representation or subjective reflection of the objective truth as nearly as possible to the human mind." Unquote. Subject matter of the first science's apex, natural theology, God, allows the understanding of the rest of reality as a created whole, as a universe, and consequently, all knowledge that can be gained as essentially interrelated and therefore as an integral component of universal knowledge. In a second step, Newman develops the first part of an analogy that in an uncanny way anticipates powerful current initiatives in contemporary research universities. To recast the curriculum in light of a normative evolutionary naturalism, reason, volition, freedom, and mind must be studied as at best aspects of the phenomenon of consciousness that emerges from or is a mere epiphenomenon to physical and biochemical processes, in light of which they must ultimately be accountable and possibly predictable, they being reason, volition, and freedom. Therefore, history, political science, economics, literature, and language, art history, musical theory, and last but not least, philosophy, with the exception of logical positivism, formal logic, and the philosophy of mathematics and the natural sciences, can happily be eliminated from the university curriculum. Replace the physical mechanistic framework in Newman's illustration with a biological evolutionary one, and matters sound only all too familiar. In the third step of this argument, Newman completes his analogy and draws a startling conclusion. While not falsifying the definitions, principles, and laws operative in such a normative naturalistic university curriculum, ignoring the reality of human reason and volition as problemotive causes, a professor holding such a normatively naturalistic view might still convey, indeed, a radically false view pertaining to the things as they actually are. If this is true about human reason and volition, Newman argues, a fortiori then the ignoring and consequent dismissal from the university subjects of a reality infinitely superior to human reason and volition as motive causes would have much graver distorting consequences. And so Newman drives home the blade of his argument, quote, "Worse incomparably, for the idea of God, if there be a God, is infinitely higher than the idea of man, if there be man. If to blot out man's agency is to deface the book of knowledge on the supposition of that agency existing, what must it be, supposing it exists, to blot out the agency of God? If the creature is ever setting in motion an endless series of physical causes and effects, much more is the creator. And as our excluding volition from our range of ideas is a denial of the soul, so our ignoring divine agency is a virtual denial of God. Moreover, supposing man can will and act by himself in spite of physics to shut up this great truth, though one, is to put our whole encyclopedia of knowledge out of joint. And supposing God can will and act of himself in the world which he has made, and we deny or slur it over, then we are throwing the circle of universal science into a like, or far worse, confusion." Unquote. On the supposition that God exists, the exclusion of this all-important fact from the circle of universal science can only result in the omission and distortion of truth. The supposition that God does not exist is a philosophical tenet that cannot be proven conclusively, and hence can neither constitute a first principle nor a conclusion of any of the academic disciplines that belong to the secular university's circle of sciences. Ideological atheism is as unphilosophical as it is unscientific. How would Newman's argument fare in the present secular research university? It would hardly find a serious hearing. The argument, nevertheless, still has considerable heuristic value as a litmus test, even in settings in which evolutionary naturalism has achieved the status of an unquestionable dogma. For Newman's litmus test helps us understand why the academic disciplines of the contemporary secular universities are roughly but discernibly divided along the lines of the Kantian antinomy between determinism and freedom. The defenders of determinism are by and large at home in the hard sciences, the defenders of freedom in the humanities. The defenders of determinism are typically, though with noteworthy exceptions, embracing a post-humanist outlook, especially in the biosciences. They regard the human being as a highly developed animal bent on maximizing the success of its species, of which the natural sciences and their technical application are currently the most decisive factor. The most articulate defenders of a radical notion of human freedom are increasingly, though with noteworthy exceptions, embracing a transhumanist outlook. They epitomize freedom in a new existentialist sense, the freedom of design, that is, the freedom of enhancing or simply changing properties of one's own nature, intelligence, gender, emotions, body features, etc., with the assistance of biotechnology. Thus, human beings become their own designer choices. And so the extremes meet, for transhumanism is nothing but the most consistent instantiation of posthumanism, especially when the design will eventually be socially or politically enforced and collectively applied. Welcomed at first as a liberation from the contingency, corruptibility, and fallibility of human nature, as an exercise of radical Promethean freedom, and thus as the final flowering of the Enlightenment project, eugenic bioengineering will eventually result in a radical subjugation of human nature to techne, to willful production. Friedrich Nietzsche, in his very late notebooks, seems to have anticipated both the post-humanist and the transhumanist implications of a purely secular utilitarian knowledge production. Because this passage from Nietzsche's notebook is quite forceful in its undiluted consistency, I shall give it in full length. So Nietzsche, quote, "There exists neither spirit nor reason, nor thinking, nor consciousness, nor soul, nor will, nor truth. All are fictions that are of no use. There is no question of the subject and the object, but of a particular species of animal that can prosper only through a certain relative rightness, above all, regularity of its perceptions, so that it can accumulate experience. Knowledge works as a tool of power. Hence it is plain that it increases with every increase of power. The meaning of knowledge, here, as in the case of good or beautiful, the concept is to be regarded as in a strict and narrow anthropocentric and biological sense. In order for a particular species to maintain itself and increase its power, its conception of reality must comprehend enough of the calculable and constant for it to base a scheme of behavior on it. The utility of preservation, not some abstract theoretical need to be deceived, stands as the motive behind the development of the organs of knowledge. They develop in such a way that their observations suffice for our preservation. In other words, the measure of the desire for knowledge depends upon the measure to which the will of power grows in a species. A species grasps a certain amount of reality in order to become master of it, in order to press it into service. Unquote. If Nietzsche is right, the university as a humanist enterprise of education and universal knowledge is quite passé and it never existed in the first place. What Nietzsche predicts is the species relevant polytechnicum. A species grasps a certain amount of reality in order to become master of it, in order to press it into service. This is the post-humanist program. And when we include human nature itself into the reality to be mastered, we have the transhumanist program. Consequently, Newman's litmus test has lost nothing of its relevance. Rather, with uncanny prescience and precision, Newman perceived the radical implications hidden in the Baconian polytechnicum that Nietzsche eventually would lay bare. While we are busy ushering Newman, the all-too-uncomfortable Catholic intellectual, out the front door of our late modern research universities, assuring him in most cordial terms of the indubitable humanistic value of his idea of a university, which presently is most regrettably, of course, utterly unfeasible, Francis Bacon, a longtime university tenant, quietly opens the back door and beckons Friedrich Nietzsche to enter in. Newman's litmus test suggests a fundamental alternative. Either the university is nothing but a species-relevant polytechnicum, be it as the tool of mastering nature by pressing it more and more into the service of the human species, or be it as the launching pad for mastering human nature itself, technical and genetic optimization of the human being into some cyborg, super or transhumanity. Or the university and its education presupposes the possibility of universal knowledge and aspires to universal education as an end in itself, as a contribution to a more perfect form of existence. In this latter case, the knowledge that the first science yields, culminating in theological knowledge, unavoidably bears upon all other knowledge. Newman's litmus test links the question of the nature of the university and of a proper university education to the question of the nature and end of the human being, to the question of the nature of human flourishing, and to the ways of realizing a more perfect form of human existence. There's only one kind of university that can meaningfully inquire into these questions of a fundamentally philosophical and theological nature, and regard them as integral to university education itself. This is Newman's university. The Baconian counterfeit, in its most advanced state, the Polytechnic Utiliversity, will brush questions of this kind aside as unscientific. For an inquiry guided by such philosophical questions does not contribute to any tangible, that is, measurable knowledge making. Such an answer will, of course, convict the late modern research university only of its tacit Baconian ideological commitments. Newman would regard such a university as decapitated, as unable to reflect philosophically upon the ideology that drives its judgments and its operations, in short, as the university's counterfeit. If Newman is indeed right, the university disciplines resemble an arc. Its keystone stabilizes the whole edifice. Remove it, and the arc collapses. All stones are still there in their distinct integrity, but now lie in an indistinct heap. On the undergraduate level, the current multiversity or utiliversity, absent the keystone, resembles such a heap, an ever-growing heap indeed. While each stone, each field has its proximate integrity, the relationship between all of them is utterly unclear. accepting, of course, certain subcoherences between mathematics and the natural sciences and among the natural sciences. In this situation of a curricular and disciplinary heterogeneity and even confusion, several disciplines are advancing themselves as keystones or as multidisciplinary keystone configuration for the construction of a new arc of the sciences. The strongest contender for such a multidisciplinary keystone configuration is presently an evolutionary naturalism. An emerging new keystone configuration stretches from astrophysics via biochemistry to neuroscience, extends itself into the ruins of the humanities, and even affords its own neo-positivist philosophy of science. With this new keystone configuration, the size of the arc changes considerably, for it is paradigmatic for the ideological naturalism funding this new order of sciences to suppose that the first science or first philosophy has died and has been replaced indeed by the natural sciences themselves. With the death of the first science, many of the stones of the former arc can no longer be integrated into this new neo-positivist order. And the ones that are still to be integrated have to change their form in order to accommodate to the reduced scope imposed by evolutionary naturalism. Such a naturalist reconstitution of the remaining university disciplines for the sake of the new unity of knowledge purportedly to be achieved by evolutionary naturalism would undoubtedly affect most deeply whatever remains of the humanities, but would leave deep traces also in the other remaining disciplines. In short, the ideological imposition of evolutionary naturalism would force the liberal arts to accommodate themselves in the proverbial Procrustean bed of the Baconian University, namely to shrink into the prescribed form, that means to accept their thorough instrumentalization, or to be cut off. And that would not be the end of the trouble. Rather, the new naturalist structure of the arc of university disciplines would be haunted by the specter of Nietzsche. For philosophical naturalism remains inherently vulnerable to the destructive acids of genealogical skepticism. Despite the realist intuitions at work in the natural sciences, the superimposed philosophical naturalism invites its own genealogical deconstruction. Among tool-making and tool-using animals of the species Homo sapiens sapiens, truth is nothing but a cover for domination. Or more radically and naturalistically conceived, the will to power is the only truth there is. Consequently, as Hobbes already understood, Homo homini lupus, the human is a wolf to his or her fellow human. There is nothing more threatening than another's truth imposed upon us in order to subdue or crush our will of self-assertion. Such a genealogical deconstruction of the reigning philosophical naturalism would, of course, issue in the very termination of the university in any, even the remotest and most equivocal sense. Being historically oblivious, the contenders of philosophical naturalism are only all too forgetful of an all-important fact. The specter of Nietzsche has arisen with and in response to the ascendancy of modern philosophical naturalism, and will erode it from the inside out until it will collapse or until it will simply be abandoned as just another false image that held us captive for all too long. In the meanwhile, however, as the new order of a consistently naturalist research university is emerging, an historically unself-conscious but ideologically self-confident ideological naturalism will increasingly define the scope and consistency of a new arc of university disciplines. In this novus ordo scientiarum, this new order of the sciences, the knowledge-making of the tool-using animal Homo sapiens sapiens will turn out to be nothing but a most advanced form of tool-making and tool-using. And consequently, in light of the newly imposed horizon of naturalism, the most advanced university training will be nothing but a training in the servile arts, in a highly advanced tool knowledge of a technical or managerial sort, in order to fix those kinds of problems that can be fixed with the help of tools. If nothing else, Newman's litmus test serves at least as a provocative reminder that the only thing that can save the university from the reductive and, in the end, detrimental distortions of philosophical naturalism and from its Nietzschean genealogical deconstruction is the discipline that allows for the widest possible scope of truth. Only with the science of sciences, the first science as the keystone of the arc of university disciplines, will the arc achieve the widest possible scope. Will the university remain open to a maximum of interrelated and complementary sciences? Will a university education remain in all areas of knowledge essentially philosophical? And will universal knowledge, as an end in and of itself, be intelligible and desirable? For, contrary to Nietzsche, human beings desire to know, not because they desire to master, but because knowledge is the proper perfection of the human intellect, which is a more perfect form of existence. It is precisely the reflective, integrating, and critical contemplation of the whole in its interrelated parts and of its first cause that characterizes the very center of the education envisioned in Newman's idea of a university. The intrinsic worth of this contemplation is most vehemently denounced and most desperately needed in our late modern techno-capitalist societies. Almost singularly among the moderns, Newman articulates the contemporary relevance of this classical wisdom. And so I give the last word to another modern Catholic intellectual who I think got it right, Joseph Pieber, who in his outstanding little book, Happiness and Contemplation, puts it thus, quote, "It is requisite for the good of the human community that there should be persons who devote themselves to the life of contemplation. For it is contemplation which preserves in the midst of human society the truth which is at one and the same time useless and the yardstick of every possible use. So it is also contemplation which keeps the true end in sight, gives meaning to every practical act of life." I thank you for your attention at this early afternoon hour.